This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. The federal government will today lodge its submission to the Fair Work Commission's annual wage review as the cost of living continues to bite hard. While stopping short of nominating a figure, the government argues that low-paid workers cannot afford to go backwards. Business groups are recommending a modest increase, less than the 7% suggested by the peak union body. Political reporter Nicole Hegarty has more from Parliament House.
This week's inflation data confirmed what's already being felt in homes and by businesses. While the consumer price index fell for a second consecutive month, the data shows the cost of food and non-alcoholic drinks rose by 8% compared to this time last year. Electricity is up 17%, rents almost 5%, and new houses 13% in the same period. The Fair Work Commission will soon decide by how much the minimum wage will increase from July. The government and business groups are adding their voice to the process today. In a statement, Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations, Tony Burke, said ensuring the lowest paid earn enough to provide for their loved ones is the best way to support workers through cost of living pressures.
The Australian government recommends that the Fair Work Commission ensures the real wages of Australia's low-paid workers do not go backwards. While nominal wages growth has lifted, high inflation has seen real wages fall behind.
While not putting a figure on how much the minimum wage should rise, the federal government's recommendation can only be interpreted as ensuring wages keep up with inflation.
Our advocacy last year helped secure a 5.2% pay increase for workers on the minimum wage.
Last year's rise was very large by historical standards, and business groups, including the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, argue in a submission to the Fair Work Commission today that another rise of that magnitude could add to inflation. Andrew McKellar is the chief executive. He's asking for a smaller increase of 3.5%.
If we go to 7%, as the ACTU is advocating, that will add back into inflation. It will keep inflation higher for longer.
He says workers will also be getting a boost in July with a 0.5% increase to minimum super contributions.
We don't want to risk further damage to the economy. A responsible wages outcome will be part of that step going forward.
Dr. Angela Jackson is the lead economist at Impact Economics and Policy.
We'd expect to see more people entering the labour market faced with a higher minimum wage, and that can increase supply across the economy as well. So there are more things at play than just that simple trade-off.
But she does warn that an increase in wages in line with inflation needs to be handled with caution.
I think it is a difficult job for the Industrial Relations Commission to weigh up.
That's Dr. Angela Jackson there from Impact Economics, ending that report from Nicole Hegarty. The cost of living is shaping up as a key issue in the Aston by-election. The seat in Melbourne's outer east is one of only three seats held by the Liberal Party in Melbourne and is being vacated by retiring former Cabinet Minister Alan Tudge. 41% of voters in the seat have a mortgage, compared with the national average of 35%. As Oliver Gordon reports, many are willing to switch allegiances based on which party they think can help them out the most.
They are great.
Next to the old kids' toys at this Speronia op shop, there's an open pantry.
Bread, milk, basics basically.
The op shop offers the food for a small donation. Volunteer Debbie has never seen demand this high.
Whatever we've got, we don't have a choice sometimes of what we get, but they're quite happy to take what we've got.
Have you ever seen this many people come in?
Not as much as what the last few months are. It's going up quite a lot. The food goes as fast as we can get it.
One of the people coming in for groceries is pensioner Michael. The Aston voter wants politicians to allocate more money to help older people like him.
To help more of the aged, the pensioners, and for hospitals.
We know there's a cost of living crisis on at the moment across Australia. We can see here there's a food bank that's been set up. Are you struggling with the cost of living crisis?
Yes, I am a bit, yes. I have to be careful what I do, how I spend my money.
The swing voter is leaning towards supporting Labor.
I'm just not quite sure. I know the Albanese Party. I can see what I'm getting. I'd like to look more into the Liberal Party before I give my final vote, but most likely the Albanese Party.
If the Labor Party is to pull off an unlikely victory in Aston, getting voters like Michael across the line is critical. At pre-polling, Labor candidate Mary Doyle says many are coming to her with cost of living issues. She says many are responding well to the Albanese government's commitment to making childcare and some medicines cheaper.
But look, you know, you can never tell fully. There has been a lot of warmth, absolutely, but it is in the hands of the voters, and it is my fervent hope that I can turn this very, you know, very traditional sort of Liberal seat to Labor.
Her Liberal opponent, barrister and Melbourne City Councillor Rashina Campbell, is hearing different things. On pre-polls, she's being told many blame the Albanese government for recent cost of living spikes.
So families are very anxious that Labor doesn't have a plan on cost of living.
She says there's also discontent about cuts to road and rail projects in the area.
In Labor's first budget, they scrapped those projects, and for families here, it's making a real difference. Time that they're spending on roads and, you know, I've spoken to one mum who says it's adding 40 minutes a day to her school drop-off and pick-up. That's time they're missing out at home or at work. So life is harder in the outer east because Labor has shown it's happy to take it for granted.
Voters in Aston head to the polls tomorrow.
That's Oliver Gordon reporting there. A member of the Indigenous Voice to Parliament Referendum Working Group is hopeful that the debate over the referendum will be respectful. A Voice to Parliament would be a permanent body representing First Nations people that would advise government on policies and laws which would impact their lives. The Voice Bill was introduced to Parliament yesterday and will now be examined by a parliamentary committee for the next 6 weeks. Opposition leader Peter Dutton was not in the chamber when the bill was introduced, as he was in a pre-arranged meeting. Professor Megan Davis is the Balnaves Chair in Constitutional Law at the University of New South Wales.
Look, I mean, I can't speak for Peter Dutton or the LNP. I mean, obviously people thought it was disappointing that he wasn't there. But aside from that, you know, it was a very historic day, so we're not focusing on him. We're focusing on the work ahead in terms of engaging with the Australian people on the referendum.
Given the importance of the referendum, were you disappointed?
I didn't feel anything, really. I mean, you know, we've got a big job to do in terms of educating the Australian people on the importance of the voice to Parliament. What the LNP choose to do is up to the LNP. There are a number of members from the opposition in the House yesterday, but it's up to Dutton what he chooses to do in relation to that.
As the campaigns for yes and no gather pace, are you confident that it will be a respectful debate?
Well, we hope it'll be a respectful debate. I know in terms of the those First Nations people who are advocating for a yes vote. But, you know, we're being also told that those who were experienced in same-sex marriage and other campaigns, that it can become very difficult. We've spoken about that yesterday when we met with Linda Burney about the impact it may have on the community. But one does hope that it will be conducted in a respectful way.
The Human Rights Commissioner, Lorraine Finlay, has said the voice will undermine foundational human rights principles of equality and non-discrimination. Five former human rights commissioners have disagreed. What's your view?
Well, you know, I'm an international human rights lawyer. I've served as an expert in Indigenous rights and human rights on the UN for 12 years. I don't agree with her assessment of the voice in terms of my work on constitutional recognition for 12 years. It's very much embedded in principles of and human rights. And in particular, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. International law says that you can create mechanisms that don't violate equality at all, but in this instance, do provide voice to a marginalised and, you know, small-numbered group that has great cultural significance to the nation. So I don't agree with her assessment of international law.
What sort of role could the voice have on advising the states and territories on issues that affect Indigenous Australians?
Well, I have no doubt that once the voice is passed at a referendum and is set up, that its advice and work will cascade throughout the Federation. That's kind of the nature of our Federation. obviously since 1967, the Commonwealth has been the primary partner in Indigenous affairs, but states and territories play a really critical role, base, of course, because the Constitution distributes powers across the Federation, and the, some of the primary areas do fall within the scope of states. So, of course, states and territories are going to, you know, at certain points draw upon or be influenced by the work of the Voice.
That's Professor Megan Davis there, the Balnaves Chair in Constitutional Law at the University of New South Wales. An American journalist has been detained in Russia, accused of espionage, and could face up to 20 years in prison. Evan Gerskovich is the first reporter to be held on spying charges since the end of the Cold War, in a further sign of deterioration between the nuclear-powered countries, is our North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova says 31-year-old Evan Gerskovich was detained because his work was not that of a journalist. Russia's main security service, the FSB, claims Mr. Gerskovich was trying to steal so-called state secrets relating to the activities of the Russian military-industrial complex. Mr. Gerskovich's employer, the Wall Street Journal, categorically denies the allegation and says Mr. Gerskovich is a trusted and reliable reporter who was just doing his job. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby denounced the detention.
The targeting of American citizens by the Russian government is absolutely, completely unacceptable. And we condemn Mr. Gerskovich's detention, and we do so in the strongest terms. We also condemn the Russian government's continued targeting and repression of journalists.
Thomas Firestone worked previously in the US Embassy in Moscow as a legal advisor. He says the Russian government could have multiple different motives to detain Evan Gerskovich.
Maybe that they want to exchange him for somebody else, or that this is revenge for something the US government has done. There are a number of recent espionage charges that have been brought by the Department of Justice, as well as other foreign Western governments.
Last year, WNBA basketball player Brittany Griner was detained by Russian authorities. She was eventually released after 294 days when the US agreed to release convicted arms dealer Victor Boot, also known as the Merchant of Death, in return. While former US Marine Trevor Reed's freedom from Russian detention came with a prisoner swap for a Russian convicted of drug importation.
One of the unfortunate consequences of not just the Griner case, the Trevor Reed case before that, they were, you know, we had to get them out. And those were, you know, very serious Russian criminals who were exchanged to get them out. So it may be on their minds that we can get somebody out also for in this case.
Russia says Mr. Gerskovich will remain in detention until at least May the 29th. The White House says it understands journalists are doing important work in Russia, but says its strong warning is for all U.S. citizens to depart Russia immediately. This is Carrington Clark in Washington, reporting for AM.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has confirmed this week he's reached an agreement to station strategic nuclear weapons inside Belarus, a nation to the north of Ukraine. After Moscow intervened in Belarus in 2020 to help its dictator Alexander Lukashenko to crush pro-democracy protests, its regime has been increasingly willing to meet the demands of the Kremlin. An opposition politician who says she won the last election in Belarus has told AM that until democracy comes to her country, Ukraine will be under constant threat from Russia. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane spoke to her in Vilnius, where she lives in exile.
When Svetlana Tikhanovskaya ran for president in 2020, she campaigned to release all political prisoners. There's at least 1,500 political prisoners in Belarus right now, including 33 journalists, the Nobel Peace Prize winner Alice Bialytsky, and Svetlana's husband Sergei Tikhanovsky, who is currently serving a 19.5-year sentence. In 2020, Lukashenko claimed he won over 80% of the vote, but hundreds of thousands of Belarusians stormed the streets in protest at what they saw as a rigged election. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya says the day after the election, she was warned by security services that she had to leave the country.
I was met by two high-ranked KGB people. persuading me that, you know, you have to leave Belarus, otherwise you will be in prison for many, many years. But at that moment, I think that my internal mother won that battle, because I have a child with special needs, and I understand that my husband is in prison. Somebody has to take care of them.
Vladimir Putin helped Lukashenko crush the pro-democracy protests. He offered security assistance, a $1.5 billion loan, and weapons and ammunition from Russia were used to crack down on peaceful protests. The more Putin helped prop up Lukashenko, the greater the debt he owed to Moscow. When Putin wanted to use Belarus to invade Ukraine, the Belarusian dictator rolled out the red carpet. Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya believes that if the true election result had stood, the war in Ukraine could have been avoided.
2020, Lukashenko managed to stay in power only thanks to violence and thanks to support of Putin, and he has to show his loyalty. He understands that he's fully dependent on the support of Putin.
Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya and her exiled colleagues have formed a united transitional cabinet, an alternative government in exile that is readying itself to take over if the regime crumbles. Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya is urging the West to intensify the sanctions against Lukashenko's regime.
Because of the war in Ukraine, Belarus is a little bit overlooked, and we have to remind the world why Belarus is important, that without democratic Belarus, there will be constant threat to Ukraine, to our Western neighbours, and the war cannot be over until Belarus is free.
Our Europe correspondent Steve Canane with that report. Finally today to Adelaide, and whether it's trying to spot the Southern Cross or picking out the brightest star to remember someone special, a starry night sky is something that many of us enjoy. But one Adelaide teenager didn't know what that was like until he had remarkable surgery to save his sight. Evelyn Manfield reports.
On a hill overlooking Adelaide, 16-year-old Orlando Lepoy looks out into the night sky. He can also see the coloured lights of Adelaide Oval and the city skyline behind, something he used to struggle with.
So at night, like, the sky to me was black.
Being out at night time used to be a bit scary for Orlando.
It stopped me from doing a lot, like going out with friends, even like events. Some events I wouldn't like attend because it'd be too dark. And I didn't really want to, like, really go out of my comfort zone.
Orlando has a rare genetic condition called Leber congenital amaurosis. It impacts on the eye's retina and its ability to process light. Professor Chris Barnett, head of the Paediatric and Reproductive Genetics Unit at Adelaide's Women's and Children's Hospital, says the condition's rare, affecting about 1 in 30 to 40,000 people. It causes eyesight to get progressively worse, and in Orlando's case, he was told by the time he was 20 he'd be blind. But a breakthrough came in 2020. A new treatment called Luxturna was approved for use in Australia.
Treatment involves an injection into the back of the eye through the eyeball.
Holding on to hope, Orlando flew to Sydney for the $1 million sight-saving surgery, jointly funded by the federal and SA governments. He would become just the sixth person in the country to have the surgery.
A healthy copy of the gene is put into a virus, and the virus is allowed to infect in a healthy manner the retina, and in doing that it gets into cells and puts the healthy copy of the gene into retinal cells, and then they start to produce a healthy RPE65 protein, which then helps to restore vision.
Weeks later, out at night with his brother, Orlando looked up and his life changed.
I could see like speckles of light, and then I asked my brother, are those stars? And he said, yeah. It was pretty cool. It was like, because I've never been like understand how people see stars, so it was like, it was pretty amazing.
I couldn't believe it was quite overwhelming, and his sister and I were, you know, a bit emotional about it.
It's made me a lot more positive and more outgoing, I think.
Orlando and his mum hope by talking about his condition, they can raise awareness so others might get tested.
That's Evelyn Manfield reporting, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi,
G'day, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's quite possible in the past 6 months or so, you've been among the millions of people who've had personal data stolen by criminals after three of the biggest hacks in Australia's history. And they're just the ones we know about. Today, a data researcher on the thousands of breaches that are hidden from the public. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.